Hi there, welcome to Delvecast. This is Scott. Today we're continuing our look at the Dungeon Master's Guide 4th edition. The previous episode covers everything up to combat encounters, and now we're looking at combat encounters and beyond. So this is Chapter 3, Combat Encounters, and we see a three-quarter page spread of a Ron Spears piece of a very red image, lots of gargoyles, an elemental, like a magma monster, not sure exactly what it is, and lots of heroes fighting them. It's quite cool. So, combat encounters. Stripped to the very basics, the D&D game is a series of encounters. Encounters are where the game happens, where the capabilities of the characters are put to the test and success or failure hangs in the balance. An encounter is a single scene in an ongoing drama where the player characters come up against something that impedes their progress. This chapter talks you through running combat encounters, whether they're encounters from a published adventure or encounters you've designed yourself. This chapter includes the following sections, so combat fundamentals, which is how to run a combat as a DM, preparation, monster readiness, surprise, tips, and additional rules. So rules for actions not covered by the rules. Interesting phrasing. Cover force movement, aquatic movement, mounted combat, flying, disease, and poison. So combat fundamentals. Whether you're running a pitched battle, a tense negotiation, a pulse-pounding attempt to scale a cliff, or a dangerous run down a trap-filled passage, don't forget everything you learned in the last chapter. It's never just a combat encounter. It's a life-or-death struggle between heroic adventurers or horrific monsters. It's not just the exchange of numbers and the strategy of moving pieces around a board. It's a test of the adventurer's skill and mettle against terrible odds. So that's interesting, because before, the rules said that you should give your players a challenge, but something that's going to challenge them that's not too challenging. But here, it's talking about terrible odds, so the deck is stacked against them. Keep the pace fast, the narration vivid, and the players enthralled. So we go into some subheads, so come prepared. Before a combat encounter begins, you should have some information at hand. If you're running a published adventure, most of this information is provided for you. Otherwise, figure it out as you're creating the encounter. This includes the player's character's passive perception checks, a map and a description of the area where the encounter takes place. This description might take a form of a brief bit of narrative you can read to your players to set the scene. It could also include details they might notice, depending on the group's passive perception, and statistics for the opponents of the encounter, including their passive perception. You have monster readiness, so monsters and NPCs aren't always ready for trouble at a moment's notice. So it's got some rules around asleep. The monster or group of monsters isn't awake, and it's only marginally aware of its surroundings. Asleep monsters take a -5 penalty to their perception checks. A monster that's asleep doesn't have any prepared defences and is surprised when it wakes up. At the start of its next turn, it's ready if there's an obvious danger present, or distracted if there's no obvious threat nearby. So it goes from asleep to then either distracted or ready, and it gives you examples of each. So distracted, the monsters are doing something that occupies their attention or simply daydreaming. Distracted monsters take a -2 penalty to their perception checks. Ready, monsters have their weapons with them, but they're not necessarily in hand. They're idly waiting, not poised to engage a specific danger, but prepared in general terms to face danger. Most of the monsters the PCs meet are in the ready state, unless the PCs are particularly sneaky. And then alert. The monsters have perceived a possible threat and made themselves ready to face it. They have weapons at the ready, and they're moved to the best position to engage a straightforward attack from a likely source. They prepare any available defences, possibly including powers that enhance their combat abilities. They roll active perception checks each round. If no threat materializes after 10 minutes, most monsters revert back to the ready state. That's interesting. They roll active perception checks each round. Presumably until you actually get into combat. Surprise. So it goes on to how you determine surprise. And vision. So blocked vision. Objects or circumstances that block vision can contribute to an attempt to achieve surprise. The characters approach a dungeon door. Thick fog swirls around the moors, eerily lit by a full moon overhead. The PCs, shrouded in invisibility, try to get the drop on the ancient dragon. Blocked vision provides some degree of concealment, which is one way the characters or creatures can attempt to actively hide. Characters wandering through fog or making their way down a dungeon corridor towards an open archway are also effectively invisible to other creatures, but they might not be actively hiding. Beyond the lowest character level, surprise is rare without some attempt at stealth. Creatures that want to achieve surprise in heavy fog or similar conditions must make an effort to be quiet and stay out of sight, making stealth checks. And it's got a table around listings for a door, so your perception DC depending on what the PCs are going to hear. So a 15 for normal conversation, 25 for quiet conversation. Roll initiative. Whether it's the moment negotiations with the Duke break down or the instant the goblins spring their ambush, rolling initiative marks a real start of a combat encounter. So it goes into how you roll initiative, rolling separately, and then tracking initiative. So how you do it through combat cards, kind of index cards, a visible list using a whiteboard, a list behind the screen. Obviously with solutions like Roll20 and Fancy Grounds, they have automatic tracking, which takes a lot of the bandwidth from the DM in that way. And it goes on to running combat. So this is really an addition to Chapter 9 of the Player's Handbook, which obviously covers combat. So it tells you a bit about what you should be doing, so describing the circumstances. Dispensing information discusses, on page 26, discusses the information you should give your players that is most important in combat encounters. Avoid unfairly hitting them with gotcha abilities. Be sure to communicate conditions and states and alert them to possible dangers and hazards of their environment. Monsters and fallen characters. Don't hit people where they're down. When a character falls unconscious, monsters turn their attention to enemies who are still up and fighting. Monsters don't usually intentionally deal damage to fallen foes. Some monsters are interested only in eating and might drag a fallen character away from combat to enjoy a peaceful meal. Usually these creatures are lurker monsters that are attached to other encounters, such as a lone cavern choker. Dragging a character away is slow going, unless the monster is very strong, so the characters should always have a chance to rescue their fallen allies. Yeah, I mean, I think that's unless they completely screw up. Wolves in 4E are a good example of this. I'm not sure in the kind of the regular monster manual, but in the Essentials Monster Vault, wolves have a drag attack, so they, once they've got you, they drag you, and the whole point is that they're going to drag you into their den and then they're all going to swarm and eat you. Of course, if it gets to a point where all the other PCs are down, then yeah, of course the wolves are going to drag and they're probably going to eat you, especially if you're lower level. Legitimate targets. So when a power has an effect that occurs upon hitting a target or reducing a target to zero hit points, the power functions only when the target in question is a meaningful threat. Characters can gain no benefit from carrying a sack of rats in hope of healing their allies by hitting the rats. Yeah, that's interesting. So if you have a power that would give you some kind of healing, it has to be a threat rather than just carrying, as it said, a bag of rats, just to smack the bag of rats and then gain healing. Tracking individual monsters. So just how you track their hit points. And tracking conditions and effects. Keeping track of conditions can get tricky. For monsters, use the same technique discussed above, which is just tracking HP. Note conditions and effects on combat cards or wherever you track initiative. The players should remember any conditions in place on their characters. However, they could forget, since they have little incentive to remember hampering conditions, though they might honestly try. Mark character conditions on combat cards or a whiteboard. You might also try keeping a supply of index cards marked with conditions and the effect of those conditions, and handing the cards to players as the conditions come up. Have a bright pink index card on top of his or her character sheet. Helps even the most absent-minded player remember a condition and remember to roll a save to get rid of it. So players should also remember which monsters they've marked as special targets, such as with the Paladin's Divine Challenge or Fighter's Reign of Terror. Place cardboard or magnetic counters by the miniatures of designated targets to help everyone remember what effects are in place. Similar tokens can also remind the players which monsters are bloodied and help you remember the same thing about characters. Of course, one of the big things about 4th edition combat encounters is the number of conditions that there are on the field at any one time. So you have players who are consistently marking other creatures, which means that that creature would get a -2 to attacking any other of your allies aside from you. So it's basically to make you sticky. What we used to do was get ring tops of bottle caps and use those and put them on our miniatures. So a red might be you have fire damage or you're blooded, or a purple might be that you're poisoned or something like that. What the bad guys do. So monsters and even non-playing characters don't have the same breadth of options in combat that a player character does. Often one power builds on the effects of another. Don't hold on to monster or NPC's best powers. If you do, often they die before getting a chance to use them. Start with the big guns. So it goes into some tactics. So the monster manual suggests basic tactics for the monsters in its pages. Your first guide to a monster's behaviour in combat, though, is its role. Artillery monsters avoid melee and favour their ranged attacks. Skirmishers move a lot and avoid the front line. Soldiers and brutes engage the party's defenders and leaders. Controllers position themselves to make best use of their abilities. And it goes a bit into smart monsters, so they're acting differently than dumb ones. So they plan their actions. They're probably going to take down, so example here is a vampire might focus its attacks on the cleric, which keeps hitting it with radiant damage. Less intelligent creatures don't plan, they react. And then it's got a bit on after an encounter, so when an encounter is over, you need to address lasting consequences, scouring the room, rest, and encounter rewards. So, of course, something that is commonly done is searching the room and looting the bodies. So it says here, PCs use perception checks to find anything of interest in the room, such as treasure chests, secret doors, or a holy symbol of Zahir hidden on the body of a supposedly good priest of Pelor they just captured. The PCs scour the room, rolling a lot of perception checks. Unless the characters are under time constraint, assume that they're going to roll a 20 eventually, and use the best possible perception check result for the party. Effectively, this result equals the best passive perception check plus 10. Assume the characters spend a minute or two searching and move on to tell them what they find. That is a better system than just constantly rolling. You just take the passive perception plus 10 and you would, after maybe 10 minutes of searching, you would find everything that you would be able to find. So then it's got some DCs around searching the rooms and what the PCs might find. So secret doors and secret latches or compartments. A bit around resting up. and encounter rewards. So giving experience points, giving any action points when a character reaches a milestone, quest rewards, treasure. And additional rules. So a few combat situations come up rarely enough that the rules for them intentionally aren't covered in the player's handbook. In particular, mounted combat and underwater combat. So action the rules don't cover. Your presence as the Dungeon Master is what makes D&D such a great game. You make it possible for the players to try anything they can imagine. That means it's your job to resolve unusual actions when the players try them. So it says here, use the DM's best friend. This simple guideline helps you adjudicate any unusual situation. An especially favourable circumstance gets a +2 bonus to a check or attack roll, or gives it combat advantage. A particularly unfavourable circumstance gives it a -2 penalty. So you can see here where the designers of 5th edition really took combat advantage as that almost universal modifier. Because combat advantage in 5th edition is nearly mathematically a +2 or a -2 bonus advantage disadvantage, just rather than obviously getting a penalty or a bonus, you're just rolling two dice instead. Cast the action as a check. If a character tries an action that might fail, use the check to resolve it. To do that, you'll need to know what kind of check it is and what the DC is. I think that's fairly self-explanatory. Setting improvised damage. Sometimes you need to set damage for something not covered in the rules. A character stumbles into a campfire or falls into a vat of acid, for example. Choose a column on the difficulty class and damage table based on the severity of the effects. Use a normal damage expression for something that might make an attack round after round, or something that's relatively minor. So then it's got this table. So if you've got your levels first to third, it gives you kind of what normal damage would be, if it's moderate or high, or limited damage. Again, low, medium, high. So it goes on to cover. So cover from melee attacks. Covering melee attacks comes up most often when the target is in a square at the corner of an attacker's space, and a wall or other solid obstacle fills one of the squares between them. If the target of the attack occupies the same square as a pillar or tree, the terrain also grants cover. If the attacker is trying to jab the target between the bars of a portcullis, the target has superior cover. So determining cover from the melee attacks. Defender's burden. The target of a melee attack has to prove it has cover. That proof consists of a line between the attacker and the defender that is blocked by a solid object. Corner to corner. The defender has cover if an imaginary line from a corner of the attacker's space to a corner of the defender's space is blocked. And then goes into kind of ranged attacks as well. And close and area attacks. So cover is a big part of the tactical combat of 4E. We've got a section of forced movement and terrain. So how to use difficult terrain, blocking terrain, challenging terrain, hindering terrain, and how forced movement affects that. It's got a bit on precipitous terrain. So when you design an encounter area, don't put a first level characters in a fight at the edge of an 80-foot cliff. The 8d10 points of damage from falling off that cliff would be lethal even to the group's fighter. The table below classifies the distances of falls according to their severity by character level. A painful fall does significant damage to characters of the indicated levels, but shouldn't kill a character who is not yet bloodied. A perilous fall might kill a bloodied character and could leave a character at full health bloodied. A deadly fall could kill a fragile character, will probably make a character bloodied, and threatens significant harm even to characters who has more hit points than any of his companions. So I don't necessarily agree that you shouldn't have a fight near a cliff that could kill characters. I think that's actually a good thing to do very occasionally because it changes their tactics. As long as you're explaining that a fall from this cliff would kill you, then their tactics will change and there's a real threat there. Aquatic combat, so how it impacts creatures with fire keywords, how characters using weapons from the spear and crossbow weapon groups take no penalty to attacks. Creatures move using their swim speed. And then there's a bit of movement in three dimensions. And it goes on to mounted combat. So there's quite a bit on this because it's talking about mountain rider targeting, so targeting a mount, targeting a rider, the benefits of having a mount, opportunity attacks, mounts in combat, so mounting and dismounting as a standard action. Initiative, you and your mount both act on your initiative count. If you and your mount separate, you both continue acting on the same initiative count. Your mount can use a standard action to attack instead of you. If you don't have the mounted combat feat, your mount takes a -2 penalty to all its attack rolls. So that's not attacking mounts, it's attacking mounts. So you would sacrifice your attack to for your mount to attack. And then it's got how fly, crashing, so crashing at a safe distance, falling, high altitude crashes from extreme altitudes. So you get kind of into these finicky rules here where you've got special flying rules at clumsy flying. A clumsy flyer takes a -4 penalty to attack rolls and defenses while flying. These creatures are ill suited to fighting in the air. So if you've seen the monster manual, you'll find that it might say flying clumsy. Clumsy grounded. A creature that is clumsy when grounded takes a -4 penalty to attack rolls and defenses when on the ground, not flying. So you might have a bat, for example, it says in here, is agile in the air but clumsy on the ground. And while I say those are finicky rules, they're all fairly straightforward. It's context, but it's -4 penalties. Aerial terrain, so swirling air currents, flying debris, clouds providing concealment, towers, floating castles, and other structures provide cover. That's quite cool. I'd quite like to run a full aerial combat that uses some of those things. And it goes on to the diseases. I really like the way that 4th edition does diseases. And in fact, I think Pathfinder 2nd edition, I'm not entirely sure about 5th edition D&D, has taken quite a lot from what 4e did, where you have an initial effect and then you use a disease track. If you fail your roll. So, for instance, blinding sickness, often spread in tainted water, blinding sickness leaves its victim sightless. So, the initial effect is the target loses one healing surge that it cannot regain until cured. And you need to do an endurance check. So, in order to improve it, it's a DC of 26. To maintain that initial effect, it's DC 22. Worse than it is DC 21 or lower. So if it worsens, it goes on to the next stage of the track, which is the target's vision is blurred, creatures beyond 10 squares of it have concealment. And then, of course, if it gets worse than that, the final state is the target is blinded. So it's got a few different examples of diseases in here. It's got quite a few. Shakes, mind fire. In the initial stages, victims of mind fire complain of burning pain in their head. Later, they sink into stupor. So they become dazed at the end of that. Hell fever, slimy doom. And it's got a lot on poisons as well and how poisons work. So poisons have an after effect. You can put poisons on your weapon. So you might have blood of Zahir. This deadly red venom is said to come from the veins of the serpent god. That's quite cool. So all poisons have an attack. So this is versus fortitude. In fact, I think all of them are versus fortitude, maybe apart from a couple. Insanity Mist is versus will. So ongoing 10 poison damage and dazed save ends both. If you remember, in 4th edition, a save is a flat roll that you need 11 or over. And then we're on to chapter 4, building encounters. So this covers monster roles, encounter components, encounter templates, and encounter settings. And we have a William O'Connor large image of a black dragon just about to breathe fire onto a, I think that's going to be a warlord. And they appear to be in like, on a bridge that the dragon's just destroyed. So all of this imagery is really kinetic. I really like it. So monster roles, a lot of you will also already know that every monster has a certain role, just like PCs do. So there's artillery, who are generally ranged combat, that don't really get into melee. There's brutes, which is all about dealing damage, but they have lower defenses and higher hit points. Controllers, which is all about manipulating their enemies. Lurkers, who tend to avoid attacks. You can have them pop in halfway through a combat to be a little bit more devastating. Minions, who give you that cinematic feel because they all have one hit point. So you can have loads of minions in a battle. Skirmishers, they tend to use mobility to threaten PCs. So they have a lot of abilities where if they miss or a player misses, then they're able to step back or move away, and so they're always kind of running around the battlefield. Soldiers are really what drags combat out, and I don't tend to use them because of that, or if I do and they're a really cool enemy, I will lower their defenses. Because they tend to have high defenses and average to high hit points. They don't do a whole lot of damage. And they tend not to move around a lot. So they kind of just stay there. But what soldiers tend to do is they tend to work quite well together. So if you think about Magic the Gathering and a white weenie deck, where you might have a lot of soldiers, but if you keep on adding soldiers, you keep on getting bonuses for the number of soldiers you have. That's the kind of thing that's there. I think that might have actually been taken from Magic. And then elite monsters. So these are generally much tougher. It counts as two monsters of its level. They're essentially mini-bosses. Solo monsters. Solo monsters are, again, they can be really cool, but they can also be an issue in terms of dragging out a combat. And leaders. So a leader is not a standalone role. It's an additional quality or sub-role of some brutes, soldiers, skirmishers, lurkers, artillery, and controllers. Leaders are defined by their relationship to the monsters under their command. So they can grant special abilities to the monsters that they're controlling. So we go on to encounter components. So one of the great things about 4th edition is it makes building encounters really, really easy. And this chapter, or this section, covers that. So it's the experience point rewards, what XP monsters should you have in an encounter. So determining your XP budget and then spending it. It's really on point. It's much better than, say, 5th edition, where the challenge ratings are really skewy. You can really set a challenging encounter or a simple encounter very easily with this. And it gives a load of encounter templates, which is really cool. So it gives you an example of what that encounter is. So, for example, Dragon's Den. So some monsters are so powerful that they pose a threat to the whole adventuring party just by themselves. Dragons, of course, are the most famous example, but other creatures such as beholders, purple worms, and hydras also fit the bill. Dragon's Den encounters pit the heroes against a single solo monster. Often the fight is in the monster's chosen den or lair, but sometimes it might be a chance encounter somewhere else. For example, when a hunting dragon spies the party travelling on a road far below and decides to drop in for a snack. So then it tells you what it should be, if it's easy, standard, hard, or hard. It's got ones for wolf pack, substituting monsters. It's got a battlefield control template, which includes lots of controllers and skirmishers. And then it goes on to encounter settings. So creating interesting areas. With 4th edition, it's about set pieces, so creating a larger area that's got a lot going on in the encounter. So it says here, having room to move. So for most encounters, the minimum is an area roughly 8 to 10 squares on a side. For an important encounter, considering a space as large as 16 or 20 squares on a side. Bigger creatures need more space, obviously. Avoid symmetry. Symmetry is boring. Fighting in one square or rectangular room after another is dull and doesn't allow for much tactical variety. Let rooms branch out of into corridors, alcoves, and antechambers and find ways to draw some of the fighting into these areas. Also build rooms using all three dimensions, large platforms and raised areas, depressions and pits, along with galleries and overlooks are interesting and can produce fun tactical situations. So in the campaign that I'm running at the moment with my 4th edition group, there's an encounter that's going on at the moment, which is in a kind of a beast den. So it's goblins, and they're kind of these beast tamers. You've got a load of wolves that are trapped in cages, and the map is, it's a loop, so the whole map is done in essentially two rooms. So there's one main room and there's a kind of an offshoot room. So it means that the characters are now moving around this loop. So we've got one character that's in the main room taking on all these wolves, and then the characters are moving through this other room where there are goblins, and they can move out back into the wolf room. And I'm a real fan of encounter locations that have a flow to them. So it's got a bit about terrain features, so having kinds of challenging terrain and hindering terrain and cover, blocking terrain, skill checks for those. Terrains and roles. So how each of those roles impact terrain, so what kind of terrains they like. So lurkers love obscure terrain and areas thick with blocking terrain. They usually need cover to hide from PCs or to escape out of party's reach. However, lurkers also like wide corridors and areas that give them lots of approaches to the character. A lurker wants to slip past the party's defender, making narrow passages and easily controlled choke points bad for such a monster. So with lurkers, that's, as I said, that's a really good example of where you might want a looping system, so they're able to circumvent the party and get to certain people. It goes on to getting terrain mix right. So terrain encourages choice, it encourages movement, and it makes fights interesting. We've got sample mundane terrain, so dungeon dressing like masonry wall, 1 foot thick. Stone wall, natural stone wall, and how to break those, large objects, object immunities and vulnerabilities, a lot around outdoor terrain, so hills, ice, swamp, streets, murder holes. Oh, there's some really nice art here actually. That's really cool. So there's an art on piece on page 66, and it's an adventurer potentially a halfling whose torch is going out, and she seems to be in a crypt, and there's these ghouls that are just creeping out from around her as the torch goes out. That's really nice. So this moves nicely onto the light sources. So how light sources work, their radius, brightness, and duration. So it has things like phosphorescent fungi, sacrificial brazier, magma, forge. I have to say, this is people criticize 4th edition for not being D&D, but for me, this is very D&D. Oof, sample fantastic terrain. So we've got some really cool things here, like blood rock, the site of a ceremonial sacrifices, a great slaughter, or some other calamity. The spirit of death hovers over blood rock. A creature standing in a square of blood rock can score a critical hit on a natural die roll of 19 or 20. I love that kind of thing in this edition. Grab grass. This thick, tough grass grows in deep forests of the Feywild or in areas where Feywild's magic filters into the material world. Creature that falls prone in a square of grab grass must make a strength check to stand up. So, if you build an encounter with grab grass, you'll want enemies who are probably going to knock down the PCs. Got things like sacred circles, lodestones, spider webs. Okay, well, before we go on to chapter 5, I'll probably end it there because that was quite a large chapter. So chapter 5 is non-combat encounters, which is all around skill challenges, puzzles, and traps and hazards. So I think this is going to be really interesting. Well, I know it is a really interesting chapter because I've read it before, but it was a while ago. So thank you again for tuning in, and we'll return next time.